You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We just heard special coverage from NPR of the jury verdict in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. If you want to follow that coverage, you can do that on our other network, the NPR News and Classical Music Network. You can do that at WPR.org. Now, we will be taking a look at that verdict with David Schultz, professor of political science and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. You can join in with your reactions at 800-642-1234 to the guilty verdicts in all three charges: second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. Join in with your reactions, what you're hoping may come out of all of this, at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is with us now. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me again.
I know you've been watching this trial closely. We've talked to you about it in the past. Your reactions, first of all, to the verdict, guilty on all three charges.
Well, on one level, not surprised at all. I think the prosecution put up an exceedingly good case. And if we, as we were watching the trial, and what many of us were surprised by was what seemed to be the relative both brevity and weakness of the defense case last week. And I think it spoke to the fact that, A, the prosecution had put on a fairly overwhelming case, and B, as we're seeing as a result of the verdict today, the defense didn't have a really strong argument. At the end of the day, when the prosecution said, you know, believe what you see, believe that 9-minute and 29-second video and watch that. I think at the end of the day, in part, the jurors believed it, and the prosecution put up the supporting evidence to reinforce what their senses, what their intuitions were telling them. So on that level, we sort of had a hint going into it that just by looking at the number of witnesses and how many of us assessed prosecution versus defense case, it was going to be going in the direction of the prosecution. Wasn't sure if it was going to be guilty on all three counts, but not a surprising verdict.
And David, the timing here, when the announcement came out that the jury had reached a verdict, it would be announced already this afternoon. Did that, I know we can't predict things with 100% certainty, but did that tip your hand that if they're going to do something quickly, it was probably going to involve guilty verdicts?
Yeah, it did, actually. I originally thought that the jury would spend all day today reviewing the charges, debating and so forth, and that we wouldn't see a verdict at least until tomorrow on Wednesday. The fact that when I heard it, what, approximately 2 o'clock today that they were in, I thought, there's no way this was going to be an acquittal. I mean, after they rested yesterday, I thought acquittal was highly unlikely. And again, after what, 11 hours of deliberation, it's like, yes, this is a good sign for the prosecution. Again, not realizing how good of a sign it was, but should have thought about it, is that I couldn't have imagined a situation where they said after 11 hours, we're done. We've reached guilty on, let's say, one, not guilty on two others. In some sense, this makes a lot of sense in terms of how it came in.
This isn't it. As we heard the judge talking after dismissing the jury, the guilty verdicts are in. Sentencing still remains to happen. Can you talk, David, about that process now?
Well, Minnesota has sentencing guidelines in which we have a complex sentencing grid in which there's sort of presumptive sentences that somebody will get for each of the crimes here. You heard the judge mention something about sort of Blakely hearings and so forth. And what happens now is that there'll have to be some additional information that will be coming in from both sides regarding why perhaps the presumptive guidelines for sentencing should either be upwardly departed or departed downwardly. So that's going to have to be considered, as well as what's PSI, which is called the pre-sentencing investigation, in terms of what the final recommendations are. And so we're still looking at about 2 months out, if I remember what the judge said here, in terms of what's going to happen next. So we have Derek Chauvin, who will be incarcerated at this point, and you know, they let him away in handcuffs at this point, but we still have to find out the sentencing. Now, in case people are wondering here, he's been convicted of three different charges. The presumption in Minnesota is that generally they would be serving concurrent sentences, even though convicted of all three, but the law does allow for the judge to say that these could be consecutive sentences. And I think that's going to be part of the discussion in terms of the PSI, the pre-sentencing investigation, regarding whether the judge should say that given the factors in the crime, should there be, again, consecutive or concurrent sentences.
David, what is the avenue for appeal? Is there an appeal in a case like this?
Well, there is. I'm pretty convinced that there's going to be an appeal. In fact, I will say I'm 100% convinced there's going to be an appeal. And the defense has laid the groundwork for it several times. It has said, for example, several weeks ago during jury deliberation, when Minneapolis announced that it was settling with the George Floyd family, they asked for a mistrial, they asked for a postponement of the case, they asked for a change of venue. They talked about that after Dante Wright, who was another person killed by a police officer very close to here. They asked for again a sequestering of the jury, and then Maxine Waters' comments just what yesterday. Again, there was a request for a mistrial. So I think what the defense is going to argue, on top of perhaps many, on top of perhaps, let's say, trial errors, which we have yet to see what they're going to identify, I think they're going to argue that the atmosphere surrounding the trial was such that it was impossible to render a fair verdict.
Who would that go to then? What is the next court of appeal resort here?
The next will be the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And just to give you some timeline here, we had another case involving Mohammed Noor, who was another police officer convicted of killing somebody. By the time he was convicted, and then we had a Court of Appeals decision, it took approximately 2 years. So we could very well be looking at a situation here before the Court of Appeals in Minnesota renders a verdict. It could be a couple of years. The Mohammed Noor case also is being appealed to the Supreme Court, which adds several more months to it. So it's conceivable, that we do not have a final verdict within the Minnesota court system for 2 to 3 years. And given how high profile of a case this is, I would not be surprised if the defense asks for, if they lose all the way up, I wouldn't be surprised for them to ask for the U.S. Supreme Court to hear the case. If that were to happen, we could be what having this conversation 3 or more years out regarding the final disposition regarding appeals in the Derek Chauvin case.
We're talking to David Schultz, professor of political science and law at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's with us to talk about the decision in the trial of Derek Chauvin, guilty on all three charges. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to those guilty verdicts? Do you have thoughts on what this could mean for policing in the future? Have you followed this trial? Do you have a question for our guest about how this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the jury verdict in the case against former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. He was found guilty on all three charges in the death of George Floyd. Our guest is David Schultz, professor of political science and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. And this is your chance to join in with your reactions to those verdicts, your questions about how the system worked here, your hopes, fears of what this might mean moving forward. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll have special coverage tonight, by the way, at 8 o'clock from NPR with more on the verdicts today. And again, you can join in now at 800-642-1234. David, the prosecution was very careful to say policing is not on trial here. Derek Chauvin is on trial here. That said, does this change anything? Does this send a message when it comes to American policing?
Well, I think had we had acquittal verdicts, it clearly would have been a setback in terms of, let us say, the issue of race relations, police reform in the United States. With the guilty verdicts across all three, it certainly moves us forward. But at the end of the day, though, remember, it still is on one level, only one verdict regarding one police officer, and a lot more has to be done. But it certainly sends, I think, a signal. Now, the question becomes at this point, how do police departments across the United States respond to this? Do they now change more of their protocols or procedures? I don't know. What's interesting in this case here, remember, is that the police chief, Chief Arredondo, testified against his own officer. As far as we can tell, that's the first time in American history that's happened. And the reason why that's important, it suggests that perhaps the police are not standing united. But at the same time, what this is suggesting is that the police were saying, well, Derek Chauvin is an outlier. He is not what represents the normal, reasonable course of policing. And the reason why I mention that is that if he's treated as the outlier, then perhaps it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to see significant police reform in the United States. Instead, it's what? The system worked. Policing generally works. We had one bad apple. We got rid of that bad apple. But clearly, this creates the conditions that make it possible, perhaps, to bring about further reforms. It all depends on, I think, in the next few days, how this is interpreted, this verdict. Is it just what? A verdict about one person, and therefore that's the extent of what we need to do because the system worked? Or is it uncovering, a broader systemic problem that needs to be addressed?
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in La Crosse. John, hi.
Hello.
Oh, what did you want to bring up, John?
Yeah, I was just wondering what kind of a sentencing is Chauvin looking at, and whatever happened to the other officers that were involved?
John, great questions. First of all, the length, potential length of sentences for Derek Chauvin, and then the other officers on the scene at the death of George Floyd, David.
So let's do the latter question first. The other three officers are scheduled for trials that begin sometime in August. And I think this verdict has a big impact upon what happens with that trial, because had Derek Chauvin been found innocent, I think it would have been harder to find them guilty because they're more or less, let's say, aiding and abetting. I should also point out, because he was found guilty, I suspect the defense is going to be partly that, guess what? They're not guilty because somebody else was found guilty. So we'll be curious to see how this plays out. Okay, the various charges here now, we've got three different indictments here, or rather, I guess say we've got three different charges here. And depending on how the judge operates here, we're going to get a variety of possibilities here, where what we have is, for example, the second degree murder case. He faces potentially up to 40 years in jail. For the manslaughter case, he faces up to, I'm just checking here, 10 years. And for the third degree murder, he faces up to 25 years. Now, Minnesota law, there's a presumption here of concurrent sentences as opposed to consecutive. But one of the things that's going to be discussed over the next few days is whether or not we're going to go with the presumptive sentences, which are in our sentencing guidelines. Are we going to go with, for example, again, concurrent versus consecutive? Are there any aggravating factors that suggest that he should get more time? And so this is what's going to be addressed in the next few weeks. But at this point, we could say that under the second degree statute, which says for imprisonment for not more than 40 years, the presumption at that one, presumptive sentence there is 150 months or 12 and a half years.
Thanks for the call, John. We'll go to Deborah now, calling from La Crosse. Deborah, hi.
Hi. I'm actually a graduate of the law school at the U of M, but I'm trying to remember, cannot the U.S. Department of Justice file civil rights charges against Chauvin and that way get around double jeopardy?
Good question,
Yes.
David. Thanks for that call. Thanks for that call, Deborah. David.
Yes, they can at this point. Double jeopardy only applies to trying the person twice in the same jurisdiction. The Supreme Court has ruled that federal versus state charges are different. And yes, my understanding is the Biden administration has been actively looking at now bringing civil rights charges against Derek Chauvin, and that could very well occur too. So he could be facing another trial. And then remember, of course, that the city of Minneapolis has already reached a settlement with the George Floyd family for about a $27 million payout. So there is multiple punishments that are being inflicted. But your basic question is correct here, is that the U.S. Department of Justice, DOJ, can come in with a civil rights violation now.
Thanks for that call, Deborah. Time for another caller. Bob is with us in Chippewa Falls. Bob, hello.
Hello. Your guest mentioned that people may try to say that Chauvin was an outlier, and I really think that's flawed. I think Chauvin's conduct is not an outlier, because the case with that National Guard's lieutenant, where he held his hands out the window, and another officer who's fortunately fired, said, "You're going to ride the white lightning, or you're going to ride the lightning, and you ought to be afraid." You know, it's the conduct, and I don't want us to personalize it to be that person is the outlier. It's really the conduct is something that's not going to be an outlier. We got to be aware that's not tolerated at all.
So, Bob, thanks for the call. In our last minute or so, David, do you see structural changes tackling what Bob says is conduct more than just from Derek Chauvin?
It's a possibility, but I think this is really the politics of what's going on in this case here, is that if, again, as I said before, if it's viewed as simply one officer convicted of murder and manslaughter in one case, no, I don't see structural. But if the message that comes from this is that Derek Chauvin's behavior is paradigmatic of a broader set of behavior we see with police that need to be changed, then yes, this is now where we've walked beyond the law, and we're now looking at the politics. What is the political mobilization that occurs as a result of the verdict today? And that's what we're going to start to see, I think, start to unfold in the next few days.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to our caller. And David, thanks for joining us again.
I appreciate it. Thanks to the audience.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota, with us today to talk about the verdict in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the jury finding Chauvin guilty on all three charges in the death of George Floyd. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent talks to racial justice activists to get reaction to the Derek Chauvin murder trial verdicts. Then she talks to a state lawmaker who co-chairs the Task Force on Racial Disparities about how that verdict could affect state policy on police brutality and reform here in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow morning at 7. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of a new book about the problem of burnout at the workplace and her tips on how to prevent it for ourselves and for our employees. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight at 8, we'll have special coverage of the verdicts in the Derek Chauvin trial. A jury today convicted the former Minneapolis police officer on all three charges. Now, tell me if this sounds familiar. You've been working just as hard, if not harder, during the pandemic, but you can't find happiness or purpose in your job, maybe like you used to. Our next guest says that may be a sign you're experiencing burnout, something more workers are feeling a year into the pandemic, upending our work and personal lives. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you feeling burned out from pandemic life? Have you noticed the lines between work and home getting even blurrier over the last year? Did you feel burnout at work even before the pandemic? Is there just something about your job, maybe? Or did you figure out a way to fix it? Maybe by leaving or staying in a better way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jacinta Jimenez is a psychologist, executive coach, and author. Her new book is called The Burnout Fix, Overcome Overwhelm, beat busy, and sustain success in the new world of work. Jacinta, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
Well, this is an important topic to you as a professional, but it was also a personal issue for you. You write in your book. Can you tell us about your own encounter with burnout early in your career?
Yeah. That's a great place to start. I thought it was really important for me to share that burnout can happen to anyone, even someone who is a psychologist. And my burnout experience is really personal in that I was actually pursuing my degree in psychology. I was setting forth my doctoral dissertation. I had the chief of Stanford Psychiatry, the School of Medicine, as my dissertation chair. And I was really self-focused. And then all of a sudden, I got a call from my mom and learned that my brother, who was very young and healthy, was suffering from heart failure. And it was really just the rug was pulled out of me. The work and life had collided full force. And my parents had run an after-school enrichment program, so they couldn't stop. They're self-employed, so they couldn't stop working. And here I was, a graduate student, pursuing to be a doctor. So I'm like, I can do this. I can step up and help my brother's care, because there was a lot of recovery process. It was a big, big deal. Well, still not compromising on pursuing my doctoral education as well, because I'm a first generation Latina. It was very important for me. And so I thought I could do both. And at first I was managing it okay. I tried productivity hacks. I worked harder. I cut down on social time. I shifted my work schedule. But as much as I tried to work harder and smarter, I noticed that my vitality, my overall vibrancy and energy was draining from me. And I had to drop out of a world-renowned psychiatrist, David Byrne's lab, and felt like I just couldn't make progress. And it was really mind-blowing for me to watch myself kind of slowly and not even fully aware until burnout had reached this point that I was burning out and that it was affecting my own health. Yes, my brother's physical health was affected, but my own personal health, my personal well-being and vitality was also affected in it. And it was a really profound experience that made me realize, like, you can't just grate your way through things. Working harder and working smarter are part of the equation. But if we're also not taking care of, you know, our well-being and investing proactively in self-care and resilience, when we are hit with adversity and stressors, that is going to take a toll. And so it was really important for me to kind of dedicate my work towards instilling this idea that mental health isn't just the absence of, or mental well-being or physical well-being isn't just the absence of suffering. It's also about flourishing and thriving and keeping ourselves strong and vibrant in the face of adversity and uncertainty and all the things that we've been experiencing in this past year.
And you bust some myths right off the bat in your book. And you just mentioned self-care as being really important, and it is. But you also say it isn't just about taking care of ourselves. It's about our employers and institutions creating situations where we're not in that burnout situation in the first place. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think it's a misnomer that burnout is just a problem of the individual, that the individual just has to work to be stronger or more resilient and more vibrant. And yes, we can benefit from that. But humans exist in a system, right? We can't look at an individual without looking at the system or environment that they exist in. And we also can't look at the system or work environment without looking at the people and what they're doing to take care of themselves that make up that system. So it's a mutually reinforcing overarching kind of system approach to really treating burnout, where we have to address it at the organizational level while also helping people find ways to foster their resilience and well-being in the process.
And another myth you tackle, every generation has concerns about the kids today. They're soft. They lack discipline. They're not as tough as we used to be. And that's why burnout's increasing. It's not a structural problem. It's a problem with the youth. You say no.
No, yeah. What research has found is that burnout happens when there's a mismatch between our capacities as humans, or the nature of the human, and the nature of work. And given how quickly our world of work is changing at unprecedented paces in so many ways, like I'm in here in San Francisco, I live and breathe in Silicon Valley, and I can attest to how fast things are changing. And as humans, we are not able to adapt as fast to these changing environments that are happening to us. And when that mismatch happens or that gap grows between, again, our capacities as humans and the nature of our work or environment, that's going to take a toll. So it's not about us not being tough or gritty. It's about that this mismatch is growing. And I tend to think that, you know, we're entering into this new world of work, but unfortunately, many of us and the organizations that we work in are hanging on to outdated formulas of what it takes to be and sustain our success in a new world of work.
Justina Jimenez is with us, psychologist, author of the new book, The Burnout Fix. She's talking about the problem of burnout and how we can tackle it in our work lives and how employers can help avoid burnout for their employees. Jacinta, it's more than just a scented candle and a nice bath or something like that. You've got a process for evaluating our own burnout, and we could put a lot of work into this. Where do we start? If we start to notice that we have these burnout feelings, what are some of the first steps we can take?
Yes. And it really cannot be, burnout cannot be solved. Like you said, like one-off coping strategies is not going to solve burnout. Burnout is a very complex problem. And so complex problems require multifaceted integrative solutions. When you're first noticing it, that's half the battle, because burnout is quite insidious. It sneaks up on you over time. And it's not until it's manifesting really strongly in these like three core components, which is exhaustion, cynicism, where you have low levels of job engagement, and then inefficacy, a lack of productivity or feelings of incompetence. When those three things come together, that's when burnout happens. But we don't almost notice it until it's like really causing problems in our work or personal life. And so that's half the battle, is just realizing it. And then the second thing I would recommend to people is to figure out, so the research has found there's six mismatches, and I can go through them really quickly, that lead to burnout, between that mismatch that I was talking about between a person and their work. And one of them is fairness. So if someone's doing job promotions and you were set up to get that promotion and you didn't get it, that can lead to burnout. The obvious one is workload, right? Too much work, not enough time to do it. But there's not so obvious ones that people may be surprised to learn about, that it's not just I worked myself to exhaustion. Burnout can happen from a breakdown in community. If you have lack of belonging or a caustic work environment, if there's a values misalignment. So your job, you set out to follow the mission of your work, and your boss is telling you to do something that's not aligned with that mission, that will take a toll. And then the other one is reward. So you're not getting adequate reward, and that can be social, intrinsic, and not just economic reward. And then the final one is control. If you're being micromanaged or have little control and lots of uncertainty, that sets up for what psychologists call learned helplessness. And it's like, why even try to make a change at my job if I can't control it? So knowing which of those six mismatches you land on can give you an insight into where to start to address it. And the more granular you can get, the better. So it's not just about I overworked and then I got exhausted. There may be more to it than that. And so having that knowledge can go a long way in empowering you to take the right steps.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ross is with us in Middleton. Ross, hello.
Hi, Robin. Hi, guest. So I retired last year, right when the pandemic was revving up. I was in healthcare, and the reason my job got stressful is because you're dealing with people who are in stressful situations, and so you're working with them and with workload and all that sort of stuff. It can be really, it can lead to burnout. In my case, I felt like it did. My remedy was to cut back my hours, and I don't know if that's a luxury, because I knew it basically means less money. And so my recommendation that I would try to tell those younger workers before I left, before I retired, is to try to set up your lifestyle in such a way that you don't have to live working full time. That is, if you work full time and you enjoy it and everything's good, but try to live as if you're working, say, 80%, just one or two shifts, which I guess, what would that be? That would be like, if it's a 40-hour week, it might be 32 hours or just that little bit of extra time really helped in my case.
Ross, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. I appreciate that. Jacinta, what do you think? He retired ultimately, but the idea of I can cut back my hours, I can cut back my expenses to match it. So what do you think of that solution that Ross offers there?
Yeah, I think it's so important to not. So stress isn't bad. It's chronic stress without recovery that is really the culprit. We were designed as humans to have short periods of stress, but we also had that downtime. So the more we can craft a life, if we do have the luxury of cutting back on hours, that's ideal. But crafting a life in which we can stay in what I call in my first chapter is pace for performance, staying in our stretch zone. So we're not going to our stress zone, but we're still stretching ourselves. We're getting peak productivity, but we're not in that point where we're chronically stressed. So knowing where to stretch to and not stretching beyond that point and working around conditions, whether that is cutting back down on hours or whether that's intentionally setting up little micro moments of pause or respite in between high stress periods at work, even on a daily basis, like micro rest to get your nervous system back down so you don't have that chronic nervous system stress is so important, because if we stay in that chronic stress place, that's where we have excessive fatigue, insomnia, high blood pressure, all those things that happen when we are perpetually feeling nervous system activation. So it makes a lot of sense what Ross said.
Thanks a lot for that call, Ross, at 800-642-1234. And part of how things can go wrong in these situations, you talk about this idea of untidy thinking. What do you mean by that?
Yes. So our minds are our central processing unit, basically, for our experience of the world. And I truly believe, just like we, keep up our dental hygiene by brushing our teeth, or we keep things tidy in our life, we need to be putting as much effort into making sure that our minds are tidy. And that doesn't mean, fully clearing your mind of anything or thinking robotically. It just means paying attention to your thoughts. And the biggest thing I talk about to stave off unhealthy thinking patterns is to really approach your mind, have a mindset of choosing curiosity over concern. So we're wired to not like concern. It's not viable for us, evolutionarily speaking. People rather receive a shock now than have a shock at some point later on in the day because we hate uncertainty so much. But what that does is our mind paints stories to create a sense of uncertainty. And those stories, as we all know, can be accurate or not and cause a lot more stress than we need to. So if we can create curiosity to go, wait, is that story correct? What could be true? And how do I look at this more compassionately? We can save ourselves a lot of actual mental energy, which is huge for energy management and also stress management as well.
We're talking to Jacinta Jimenez, psychologist and author of the new book, The Burnout Fix. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How can you tell when you're approaching burnout on your job? Has a blurred line between work and home, maybe if you're working from home, made burnout more of a reality in your life? If you are a manager or supervisor or business owner, have you seen burnout on your job? Have you done things to help avoid it for the people who work for you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about overworking and burnout with Jacinta Jimenez. She's a psychologist and author of the new book, The Burnout Fix, Overcome Overwhelm, Beat Busy, and Sustain Success in the New World of Work. You could join in with your questions, maybe your own experiences, maybe your advice to share with others at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers now. Jess is with us in De Pere. Jess, hi.
Hi, I have a question kind of related to what the previous caller was talking about, too. I was working full time, doing kind of crisis work with families who are homeless due to domestic violence and sexual assault. And as you can probably hear, I have a 2-year-old in the background. And I've just been struggling a lot with trying to keep up and and ended up just recently going down to 32 hours. However, I feel no relief, and I might feel, yes, baby, at that chronic fatigue stage already, and I feel like now I'm just still as burned out doing the home life things and work life, but now with less pay. So I'm just wondering if there's any other suggestions you guys may have.
Jess, thanks for the call, and thanks for the important work you're doing. Jacinta, your thoughts for somebody in Jess's position?
Yeah, thank you for the important work you're doing. Yes, when you get to that threshold of extreme exhaustion, it is really tough to bounce back. And this is where I think a huge practice, well, two things. First is just a lot of self-compassion. So there's a lot of research on the art of self-compassion. We are so much harder on ourselves than we are to a friend. And it seems so simple. Just treat yourself like a friend and be compassionate. And when I talk about this with audiences, sometimes I get like, okay, yes, that makes sense, you know. But actually, there's deep, deep research on how, you know, looking at people with brains, looking at them in brain scans to show that this practice of compassion on a daily basis of really being soft with ourselves can give us a little bit of room to have some breathing space versus trying to feel like, okay, I'm still just running against things. The other thing is just, I think it's these micro moments. It doesn't require a huge overhaul and behavior change, but just small mini moments, because it's not realistic and feasible for me to say, hey, well, just go meditate and just go, you know, secure support and do all these things. But if it's small, tiny things that are done on a consistent and persistent basis, whether that's 1 minute to 15 minutes of deep breathing or doing a gratitude practice or just sitting and being very compassionate with yourself, those little things add up to a lot. It's the little things that actually make a difference with behavior change. So I think, but holding that compassion too, because what you're dealing with is significant and real and deserves some compassion as well.
Thanks for that call, Jess, and good luck to you. And let's maybe even hammer that point home a little more, Jacinta, because I could see somebody in a tough situation feeling burnout, feeling it affect their performance, maybe thinking, I have failed. This is a sign that something is wrong with me. And then I could see that making things even worse in this horrible downward spiral.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. And the interesting thing is that research has found that self-compassion has all the benefits of self-esteem without the downsides of self-esteem, because self-esteem comes from like this concept of comparative suffering or looking at someone else, either upward or downward comparisons of people, especially self-esteem. We look down and go, oh, look, I'm doing better than that person. But the moment that we need our self-esteem, we can't look downward to make that downward comparison, which isn't healthy anyway, when we need it most. But compassion is shown just to be as effective as having healthy self-esteem, if not more, because it actually is there whenever you need it. And it's easier said than done for someone like me who thought, well, criticism motivates you, or you've been having tough self conversations motivates me to charge harder. It has been an uncomfortable practice for me, but it has been life-changing. And the research, there's just substantial amounts of research showing how hugely effective this practice can be.
Thanks again for the call, Jess. We're talking to Jacinta Jimenez. Her new book is called The Burnout Fix. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Wausau. Jim, hi.
Hi, hello. Wonderful conversation, and thank you for having me on. Three things. I've been in management a long time, and just through my experiences, three big things that actually changed my life to take out stress. Number one is when I take a little black book with me and I make notes. That way I don't have to worry about mentally juggling all kinds of balls around in my head and to make sure I don't miss things. But along with that, I can write that down. I set that down. It's off my mind because I know I can go back to it at a different time. The second thing is laptops. Unfortunately, we're all strapped with laptops, things like that. I purposely do not bring my laptop home. I used to have a bad habit of doing it, and then I find myself on it. So it's like anything else. If you don't have to be there, don't be there and don't go there. And the third thing, probably most important, listen to your wife. If you happen to have someone in your life that's your conscience, she'll tell you. And she'll say, Jim, we need to have this time. This is not work time. This is our quality time. And it's been wonderful.
Jim, thank you so much. Lots of advice there, Jacinta. What do you think?
Oh, Jim, yeah, I love the different strategies, because I do want to say that burnout, you know, and I have this kind of five-set model in my book about how to address burnout, but it's not, you don't have a one-size-fits-all approach. Everyone has unique circumstances, life situations, and factors. And so it's about finding that combination that works for you, whether that is having the black book and the lap, you know, not having your laptop with you, or listening to your partner, and having them hold you, you know, keeping you honest about when you need to take a break. That's fantastic. It's about finding the right combination for you about how to, what works. And I definitely love the last piece about listening, you know, to your partner, because just securing support in general is so huge. We're wired to connect. We've survived as a species for centuries in tribes. And so having a support system, or having people to check in with and keep, you know, keep tabs on one another about well-being, can go such a long way in terms of A, normalizing it, that we're all struggling. If you look at the stats, so many people are burning out right now. It's really heartbreaking. It is a major epidemic in itself. The World Health Organization just recognized it. So the more we can find different ways, and also through others, goes a long way in buffering against burnout, or else mitigating the effects of burnout if you're already in it.
Thanks again for that call. Jacinta, in our last couple minutes, I mean, you write about this in the book. There's a work harder mentality. You're near Silicon Valley, home of the 80, 90 hour work weeks. Young people are told, especially online, you got to hustle. Don't waste any time on yourself. How do you convince people to change that mindset and realize that they actually will accomplish more things by doing less of that kind of thing?
Oh, I'm glad we're ending here. I love this question, because I so adamantly believe that hard work and smart work are only part of the equation for sustainable success. You are your biggest tool to make an impact on the world. And if you fail to invest in that tool yourself, you run the risk of damaging that, the very thing that you need to make an impact or have a vibrant life. And at the end of the day, the research shows us that serious work at a serious time does not come at odds with rest, recovery, or replenishment, or well-being. The two actually go hand in hand. When we are more centered, we're more resilient, we're more vibrant, we do better work. We have higher levels of empathy. We develop more creative solutions. We are more productive. And most importantly, we are healthy, well, and vibrant, and can give back to our families and communities. And everyone ultimately benefits. And that's what I try to tell organizations too. If your people are thriving and you invest in your people in that way and setting up conditions for them to thrive, everyone benefits. Your customers, your employees, and your partners. It's a mutually reinforcing upward spiral.
It's a great place to leave it. Jacinta, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Such a pleasure to be here.
That's Jacinta Jimenez. She's a psychologist, executive coach, and author of the new book, The Burnout Fix: Overcome Overwhelm, Beat Busy, and Sustain Success in the New World of Work. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, a related topic. Many American workplaces have changed a lot over the last year. Are some of those changes here to stay? Find out more, share your thoughts tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up at 8 tonight, we'll have special coverage from NPR. The jury in the Derek Chauvin trial reached guilty verdicts this afternoon. We'll get analysis from NPR at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll air news from NPR and All Things Considered with more on that topic. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time is produced by Bill Martins, Dean Knetter, Tim Peterson, Natalie Guyette, and Jana Rose Schleiss. Sarah Hopeful is our technical director, and Jay Carlisle Larson is our executive producer. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.